These United States have 6% of the world's population. We have 7% of the Earth's land area. We produce about 30% of the world's production of goods and services, and we consume about that amount. We produce about 15% of the world's exports, and of this, of manufactured goods, we produce about 20% of the world's manufactured goods. We produce about 23% of its grain, but we export about 58% of the grain. So you can see that we are a tremendous breadbasket and a tremendous productive facility for the world. Now, some people who are critics of our country raise this question. They say, oh, do U.S. citizens consume too much? And a few years ago, we had a group of people who call themselves Christians who were pushing the idea, well, it's unchristian of you to wear good clothes or to drive a nice car, live in a nice home, so you should get rid of all those things and give all your wealth to the poor people in the less developed countries and so forth. What does the Bible say? In 1 Timothy 5, verse 18, the Apostle Paul says, well, the laborer is worthy of his hire. And if we produce 30% of the world's wealth, why shouldn't we consume that much? Deuteronomy 25, 4, the Lord says, thou shalt not muzzle the ox that treadeth out the corn. The point I'm trying to make is that basically, I think we make an unfair judgment if we say that people are not entitled to control the wealth they produce. As the amount of wealth we produce goes up, so is our capability of doing good work, sharing with others. Of course, the amount that we share with others would count as, you know, that we are producing and basically consuming for ourselves, because that's how we choose to use it. Point I'm trying to make is that if we would stop consuming, there are a lot of people in less developed countries whose whole life and livelihood depend on supplying our markets, and so we would cut them out of their livelihood. So trade is beneficial both ways, and I wanted to point that out. And without our production, the world would be much, much poorer. So let's remember this. Now, I want to move to a very important principle of trade, and I'm going to state it concisely. And the principle of trade we will look at is very simple to understand. It is this. Each party to trade, seeks to maximize his own well-being by giving something that he values less in order to get something that he values more. I'll repeat that if you're taking notes. Each person seeks to maximize his or her own well-being by giving up something that he or she values less in order to get something that you value more. How many of you bought breakfast this morning? Would you raise your hand? Is there anyone that looks like none of the people went without breakfast? When you bought breakfast, basically you were making an economic decision. If you valued the money that you paid out for the breakfast less than the food you received in exchange. That's what trade is all about. When you buy an automobile, you value the money you spend less than the automobile that you get. If you sell a used car to someone, as many of us do, you value the used car that you sell less than the money that you receive. If I would ask some of you, who's willing to trade my pen? You got anything? Suppose we enter into a voluntary trade. Hey, I kind of like that pen. I value that more than what you'll give me. No thanks, I value this more than that. See, so the trade didn't take place. But had we both imputed a different value, both of us would have been better off after the exchange than before. And so voluntary trade, because of this self-interestedness that a large has built into us, naturally, through its creation, emphasized, perhaps in a bad way, by man's sinful fall, still works out so that both parties of voluntary trade benefit because they give something up that they value less in exchange for something that they value more. Okay, now another point, which is very simple yet important to recognize. The end goal of voluntary trade is simply that the people engaging in the trade may enjoy more of the good things in life than is possible than by being 100% self-sufficient. And this leads us to the principle of specialization in trade. For instance, my wife and I run a business. She can run some aspects of the business much better than I can. God has given her those gifts. There are some aspects of the business that I am more efficient at running. So therefore, I do that. So we both tend to specialize in the area where God has given us gifts. We put them together and we have a whole. For instance, suppose that you're a dentist and you can, let's say, fill 30 teeth a day. I don't know what dentists do. Maybe they do twice as much or half as much. We'll say 30 teeth a day. But suppose that you're a real superb typist and you can type, we'll say, 100 letters a day. Well, a dentist can do his own tooth-filling work, and he can also do his own secretarial work, can't he? But suppose that he hires someone who can do a better job of typing than he can that can't fill teeth. Well, he's going to specialize then in filling teeth so that maybe he, in a period of the day, can fill 40 teeth or 50 teeth a day, write no letters, and let his secretary, who is better at that, do that work. Now, here we have the principle we call absolute advantage. He is better at doing one thing, and he will do that. But we have another principle, and that is the principle of comparative advantage. Suppose that he has an absolute advantage in filling teeth and writing letters. I'm going to show you where it would pay him to hire a secretary to do his secretarial work, even if she weren't as fast of a typist as he is. And here we get into the principle of comparative advantage. It's a little bit hard to follow sometimes, but I think we can do it if we go about it just step by step. Let me erase some of this loose talk up here. And I'll use an example from the red textbook that we have over here. Let's look at two people. One fellow's name is Ken, and the other's name is Ben. Okay, and let's say that both can produce wheat and both can produce stereo sets. And let's say in a given period, we'll say a year, that Ken can produce 40,000 bushels of wheat and he can produce 40 stereo sets, 40 units. Now let's look at Ben. Ben can produce, during the same period, 10,000 bushels of wheat. So we're assuming they're farming the same amount of land, have equal, all else is equal as far as their manufacturing and farming facilities. And he can produce 30 units as far as stereo. Now, here we can see that he has an absolute advantage in producing both wheat and stereo. See, because he can outproduce Ben 4 to 1 and a third more stereos. And if we add up what the total is for their total production, we see that both together can produce 50,000 bushels of wheat and a total of 70 units of cereal. So if we look at their overall production, this is what the economy of the two men produces. Now we look at that. Well, is there any way that those men can engage in trade so that trade might be beneficial for them? The answer is yes. Even though Ken has an absolute advantage, he cannot produce Ben in either cereals or wheat. Now, sometimes we hear the statement that our factories are so productive. We used to hear this quite a bit before the Japanese invaded our markets, and it's a good thing that they did, because this causes us to be sharpen our competitive skills. But we used to hear the fact, well, it doesn't pay the people in the United States to trade with anything, because we can outproduce the people in farming and we can outproduce them in manufacturing. But because of the diversity that God has built into his universe, and we'll tie up the session by looking at this, lo and behold, it may be, and generally it is, beneficial to engage in trade, even though the people of a country may have an absolute advantage. Now, we're looking at individuals here. What I like to do is always start looking at the micro unit and back off and look at the macro unit. And the principle that we will establish is a general principle of trade that applies between individuals, between business firms, and between people of various countries. So keep that in mind. Now, what we want to do is look at the cost advantages. Okay, so I want to add something over here, where we will look at the comparative cost ratios. Okay, now I want to look at Ken and say, well, what is his cost of producing cereals and wheat? And what we do is we see, well, his cost of producing wheat relative to cereals is 1,000 to 1. In other words, assuming that we have a situation, this is in economics we call a heroic assumption, but at least this allows us to present the principle. Assuming that the resources we're using in producing cereals can be easily switched to producing land, we know it can't be, but we'll make that assumption. And it really doesn't hurt things in doing it. But we see that in order to produce one unit of cereals, he has to give up 1,000 bushels of wheat. Am I connecting with you, making a point? So if he wanted to not produce any cereals at all, he could produce zero cereals and 80,000 bushels of wheat. This is the point I'm trying to make. Or he could produce zero here and produce 80 units. So his cost of producing a cereal is that he has to give up producing 1,000 bushels of wheat. And if we look at Ben, we see that he has a lower cost ratio of 33 to 1. In order to produce one cereal, he only has to give up producing 333 bushels of wheat. Isn't that beautiful? Now, because of the principle of what we call comparative advantage, even though Ken has an absolute advantage to him, it will pay them to engage in trade because their cost ratios of production are different. And this is the key. As long as their cost ratios of production are different, then indeed they can beneficially engage in voluntary trade. Now, if they had the same cost ratios of 1,000 to 1, then there'd be no advantage. But again, because of the diversity of God's creation, very seldom do we get locked into an exactly equal cost ratio, because God made each person different. And I'll touch on the biblical citations on this in a bit. Okay, what we're trying to say here then is that Ken has an absolute advantage in both production, but Ken has a relative advantage in producing wheat, and he has a relative disadvantage in producing cereals. Or we could say that Ben has the relative advantage in producing stereos. Isn't this beautiful? Because what this means in practical terms is that the brilliant person can do all things well. And who of us don't feel kind of bad sometimes? We run across these rare individuals who seem to be able to do everything better than I can. You ever met anyone like that? And you kind of feel humbled and you think, well, gee, that person's so great and so wonderful. I'm so little and inefficient to never pay them to consider doing business with me. God took care of that. God took care of that because your cost ratios of producing things probably are different. And if the person who can do all things so well will be humble enough to listen to your advice, you can convince that person, hey, I can make you richer if you will higgle and haggle and trade with me in the free market. Okay, so how do we solve the problem? Well, basically, what we do is we will let each person specialize, and we'll show this below here. Let's look at Ken then. And let's look at Ben. And we will allow Ken to shift out of stereos into wheat until he, and you do this by trial and error, and until finally he expands his wheat production up to 70,000 bushels, and he lowers his production of stereo sets to 10 units. This will allow Ben to produce zero amount of wheat and expand his production of stereos up to 60 units. Let's add up the total. We indeed see that the total of production through specialization production is 60 stereo units and, 70. 70 stereo units and 70,000 bushels of wheat. So the net effect of free trade is seen right here. We have an excess, we have an additional 20,000 bushels of wheat produced simply through the process of voluntary trade, even though Ken has an absolute advantage in producing either one. Once you grasp this, you can see the advantage of free trade throughout the whole world. And I'm convinced in my own mind that this is God's design. This is by God's design, and to the extent that governments build up import controls and tariff barriers and so forth, it is economically hurting the people and also preventing the outworking of God's economic plan for our free trade throughout the world. Now, you might say, well, how is that additional $20,000, 20,000 bushels of wheat going to be divided? Well, that's what Ken and Ben have to giggle and haggle about. And the division of that 20,000 will depend upon their abilities in the negotiating process. They might split it down the middle, or since Ken has an absolute advantage in each one, he might say, okay, I think I should get 15,000 of the bushels and leave you with 5. But the explicit division of the 20,000 is also going to be taken care of in the free market depending upon their feelings and needs and so forth, and their imputations of value. Again, as we explained yesterday, the outworking of the things economically according to the specific gifts that God has given us. Isn't that beautiful? Now, I want to cover a few biblical citations just to kind of nail things down, and then we'll have roughly half an hour where we can have for questions and answers. We look to Romans 12:6, the Apostle Paul. I must confess that here he's speaking in terms of the church, but the principle applies all over God's creation. We're talking about, if you're thinking in terms of the principles of approach that my dear friends out in California, Rosalie Slater and Verna Hall, come up with, the principle of individuality. is basically what we're talking about here. Paul says, having then gifts differing according to the grace that is given us. God gives each of us special gifts and special interests. Russ Walton, his wife, and my wife and I were talking in the car, and Mrs. Walton was telling about her son Adam, how when he was just a young boy, 3 or 4 years of age, less than that, I think, he was already showing the gifts that God had given him as far as electronics is concerned. A little boy like that fixed your doorbell. She couldn't understand how he could do that. Some of us couldn't do it at this age. God gives each one of us different gifts. 1 Corinthians 4:7. Paul poses a rhetorical question. He says, for who maketh thee to differ from another? It is God through his creation. Each of us have a unique fingerprint, don't we? Each of us have different facial expressions and body weights and so forth, and we each have different spiritual gifts. Again, the Apostle Paul, 1 Corinthians 12:4, now there are diversities of gifts, but the same Spirit. He's speaking of the church here, but again it applies. You say, isn't there anything in the Bible that speaks about it more in a economic or production sense? Yes. For this, we can go to the Old Testament, Exodus chapter 31, verses 2 to 6. And here we have the building of the tabernacle, and the Lord is speaking. He says, see, I have called by name Bezaleel, and later he mentions another man, Aholiab, and I have filled him with the Spirit of God in wisdom, in understanding, and in knowledge, and in all manner of workmanship. So when it came time to build the temple, God had already raised up individuals, mechanics, if you will, that had the mechanical ability of molding the lead and doing the artwork and the carving and so forth to build the ark. Beautiful. Now let me share something with you. When we moved to Pennsylvania, we were shocked. Because shortly after we lived there, we got a notice with our paycheck that they withheld $10 because of what they call a work privilege tax. I just rebelled at that. I said, work privilege, who ever heard of that? Work gift, because it is God who gives people the gifts to produce certain things and specialize in such things. Yet the government, local government there, is saying that they are giving, they are taxing me because of a right that they are giving me to produce. This is important from government regulation. Think in terms of regulating professions, where you have to be licensed to do this or that. It is God who gives people gifts and the ability to train themselves in certain things. And one of the greatest tyrannical acts of the civil authority is to deign to license various professions. A great invasion, the turning over of God's system. An example of God, of the civil authority trying to play God, become humanistic, where they look upon themselves as the source of people's ability to do this or that. And I think we should think in biblical terms in that respect. So remember this passage in Exodus 31, verses 2-6. It's a beautiful passage if you see it in this economic life. And with this, I have finished the presentation. We open up the floor for half an hour or 25 minutes or so if you have any questions or anything you want to respond to. Yes?
You made a statement yesterday that I'm sure you can speak about. That was the fact that it was permissible to go into debt if it was for an investment purpose. Could you...
Okay. The
question that they come to.
The question is, yesterday I made a statement that it is my understanding that the Bible allows people to go into debt for business purposes. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay. I mentioned the parable of the talent, where the unprofitable servant that just buried his talent is castigated by the master. And remember what he said? He said, at least you could have put it out for usury. No, put it out of interest, which indicates that if he would lend it to someone, someone would be borrowing that money for a productive purpose in which they would pay interest. So in that way, we see that if that were morally wrong, certainly we wouldn't have that lesson. Now, the admonition against usury in the Bible is misunderstood by the church, generally in the medieval age, where they thought it meant the prohibition of all interest. But that's not so. If you read the Bible, you will see that there's nothing wrong with borrowing money for business purposes, as long as you don't overextend, and that's a matter for judgment. You don't want to borrow more than you need, or you can pay back safely, because then you would be borrowing recklessly. What the Bible admonishes us not to do is to lend to people who are in need and charge interest. So if you were hungry and in need, it is wrong for me to charge a brother in Christ interest. I should either give you the money or lend it to you without interest, and then when you get back on your feet, you can repay me, or I just write it off. But if you have a viable business opportunity, and you approach me and say, "Hey, Mr. Rose, look what I'm planning on doing. Would you like a piece of the action, or would you help me get started?" And I say, "Yeah, that looks worthwhile. I'll lend you money for business purpose and charge you whatever the going rate of interest is."
You see, we're trying to differentiate between an investment and someone taking out and going into debt. You know, there's a difference between someone investing in your corporation and you going out and getting into debt to a bank or any other subsidiary, and
okay. Suppose you would give me a choice of buying stock in your firm, or coming in as a partner, or simply lending you money. And suppose I choose, no, rather than becoming an equity owner in your business, I would rather just lend you the money, and you write out an IOU, or issue a bond, on which I would collect interest, you know, every year until you pay me back. There's nothing wrong with that biblically, as long as you don't overindulge. And of course, assume that you're borrowing money for a legitimate purpose and business is legitimate and so forth. Did you have a question or comment?
Wouldn't the distinction between the lending and the investment be that the lending has no risk, the investment is a risk?
Well, no. See, the lending has to have a risk. That's what validates the payment of interest. The interest, the cost of interest from an economic standpoint, has two costs. One is the cost of deferred consumption, for which there is a market price, and risk. And the higher the risk, the higher the rate of interest that would be charged on that. For instance, suppose that you were building a ship, engaging in foreign trade, which say 200-400 years ago, which is fairly risky, and I would lend money for that. Well, I would charge a higher rate of interest for that than a man who wanted to open up a retail shop next door to me where I can watch it all the time. And there's nothing wrong at all from a biblical basis for interest to be paid or charged for the borrowing money for business purposes like that. Yes, Tim.
The problem that I would have in regards to the issue of interest in the present day society, is that being involved in the mechanical or the mechanisms of the banking institutions in our day, those who are lending are not those who produce anything to lend. I think I understand a little bit about how the system works. So if I participate with the system by making liabilities assets on the books, what I do is entice them to rob from my brothers and sisters.
What?
I think you understand where I'm coming from, so could you relate that to how does a Christian knowingly, willingly participate in what I call the Babylonian monetary system?
Okay, the question is this, and what Tim is referring to, he's referring to the fractional reserve banking system that we have. And if I may rephrase the question, he says, how should a Christian consider the matter of borrowing money from a bank when the money that the bank lends to you is not money that other people have saved?
Yes.
Or But instead of that, the bank is creating money and is lending to you. And I didn't get into this in my presentations because it takes quite a bit. I do cover that in my textbook, or raise the issue of 100% reserve banking versus fractional reserve banking. And the point he's making is that when you go to a bank to borrow money, even bankers that lend the money don't understand this generally. Actually, the money is created out of thin air based on reserves that the banker holds at the central bank, which is our Federal Reserve System. So the question is, how should Christians look at this? Well, basically what happens there is when you go to the bank to borrow $100, the banker creates $100 of new money, and you use this money and go out into the marketplace to purchase goods and services with money that no one has earned. So basically, from a moral standpoint, you get control of resources with funds that no one has pulled out of the system as savings. And you're paying interest on this money to the banker. And hopefully, you will use this money profitably and repay the interest and the principal and have something left. Otherwise, you go in debt. I raise this question in the textbook, and I come up with an unpopular conclusion. Basically, the unpopular conclusion is that the fractional reserve banking system at heart and in essence is immoral. And I trace it from the Goldsmith bankers back in the early 16th century in England, where really fractional banking started in this way, where people would take gold and silver, we'll speak in terms of gold, to the goldsmith for safekeeping, because they had big safes that they could put it into, and they would get a chip saying, I am holding 10 ounces of gold for Mr. John Smith, and he can come get it any time he wants. So Mr. John Smith goes to spend that 10 ounces of gold to buy a carriage or something. The carriage manufacturer takes that 10-ounce gold certificate, is basically what it is, and then he can go to the goldsmith who's holding it and withdraw the gold. But after this went on for a while, they thought, well, as long as I can get the gold, why get the gold? I'm just going to spend it anyway. Why don't I just pass this gold certificate on to someone else that I'm buying from? And lo and behold, the goldsmith discovered that very few people were coming back to redeem their gold certificates, and once in a while, someone would approach the goldsmith and say, hey, I want to borrow some money to start a new business or maybe to build a new house. And the goldsmith would say, well, I'm sorry, I've got gold I'm sitting on in my vault, but I've got chips floating out that are representing this on a one-to-one basis. I don't have any gold that's not owned by anyone else. He said, look, why don't you just issue me an extra gold certificate, and within a few months I'll come pay it back and no one will be the wiser. Bells start ringing and the goldsmith says, hey, why shouldn't I charge this guy interest on this fictitious warehouse receipt? And at that moment, fractional banking was born. And a whole fractional reserve banking system is based on this, what I call malfeasance, and it has become accepted in our day and age, and people think I'm a kook when I say that at heart it is immoral. Because in my chapters, Money and Banking, there are a couple of principles I point out, and that is that for sound money, money must be earned before it is spent. And when you borrow money from the fractional banking reserve system, money is created and spent, it is not earned. And so we're saddled with a system that at heart leaves much to be desired. Few people actually realize that when you take out a loan at a commercial bank, money is created, and when you repay the loan, the money is destroyed. And I explain that in the textbook, and then I pose the moral question for us to consider and try to look at it biblically. And thanks for raising the question. It's not an easy problem. If I were put in a position of power, I would say, okay, God's word calls for a 100% reserve banking system. Yes?
The whole problem, it seems like, is our entire monetary system. In other words, the entire monetary system is basically made on
credit.
On temp money.
That's right.
And so it's not just whether or not you're borrowing money from a bank. It's, you know, if I go to you as an individual, I'm still borrowing money.
Well, no. See, if I have earned the money and you're borrowing from me, then I have earned that money. And when I lend it to you, I withdraw it from the spending stream and I can no longer use it. But when you go to the bank, the money that you spend is created in addition and is not withdrawn from the money stream. Basically, every time money is borrowed from a commercial bank, monetary inflation, an injection of new money occurs in the marketplace. And every time you repay a loan to a commercial bank, money is withdrawn from the money and banking system and it is destroyed. We could spend, I guess, a couple of sessions on that. Maybe we can at some time.
I just make a comment that around the United States there are many churches now that are starting to start their own earned money fund, lend money to those in their church at a more equitable non-interest rate. And you're seeing small local individuals at various points when they can withdraw from this type of system.
Yeah. Good church answer to the comment. One question here and then here.
What is the biblical position on renting your things, whether it be renting your house or your gold or your horse and carriage or whatever? What is the position of renting things in the Bible?
Repeat the question again.
The question is, what is the biblical basis of renting things, like a house or a car or a horse or something like that?
Or money.
I think we can all wrap it down to about money. And the answer is that if someone wants to make use of resources that is owned by someone else, they're asking the person to make an economic sacrifice, so therefore a payment should be made. And you can call it rent, but actually the things you refer to is really interest, because we're talking about wealth here. They would represent wealth that is owned. From a biblical standpoint, I gave you economic analysis. From a biblical standpoint, Ecclesiastes, or no, the end of Proverbs, Proverbs 31, where the good woman is eulogized, and if you read that, you will see where she goes out and engages in business practices and buys land and sells land and so forth, and so this is implicit in that. So it, for business purposes and for wealth producing purposes, it is biblical, but again, for people in need, we're admonished not to do that. My understanding of the Bible, if we want to relate all this to the money, is that it is biblical for me to charge interest to non-Christians for money they borrow from me. It is biblical for me to charge interest to Christian brothers and sisters who are using it for business purposes, but not if they need charity. For charity, I either give the money to them or lend it to them without interest. Yes, here and then here.
Explain to me that one of the reasons why certain individuals in the earth have been gathering the gold reserves to their own private coffers is that they understand a lot of these principles to the nth degree, and what they expect is that when everybody wakes up and realizes that we need a gold standard for economic stability, that they will possess all the gold, and that will give them control of the resources in the earth and the government of those resources. What do you think about that?
The question is, why are people accumulating gold? Is it because they are trying to gain control of resources eventually that they want to purchase with this gold, land and wealth and so forth? I think the main answer is that astute individuals, and this includes both Christian and non-Christian individuals, are observing what the civil governments are doing to money. And I point out to my own students in money and banking that governments are the greatest debauchers of money in the history of mankind. Every government eventually turns to debauching the currency. And when people see what is happening, they say, well, I want to put my wealth in something that will maintain its value. And God created gold with certain characteristics. where it does maintain its luster and so forth, and its many characteristics that cause men to impute value, so it retains its value. So they put things in gold, silver, diamonds, and so forth, works of art, where the governments cannot debauch, where the government debauchment of the currency isn't going to bother this, and so that they then can sell these things sometime at a later date after the monetary system comes tumbling down. There's nothing wrong with this. The Christians should be doing this, but they should not be obsessed with trying to protect their wealth to such an extent that they fail to use their wealth actively in building God's kingdom. And some Christians, I'm afraid, focus too much on the preservation of wealth rather than using it in a biblical way of building God's kingdom. Yes, sir, Reverend.
I just wanted to underscore that planting, when God plants his people, it's synonymous with growth.
Mm-hmm.
We haven't done a number in our country that to grow is wrong. And to grow economically is mortal sin.
Yeah.
That is,
yeah,
you're not really meant to make a profit. It's what you do with your growth is the key issue.
That's right.
The making of it is a command of God.
This is right.
The opposite of growth is no growth.
Is the wasting of resources and assets.
Yeah,
he points out that the opposite of growth is no growth, or the wasting of resources and assets, and that is contrary to God's admonition. If we go back to Genesis 1:26-28, we're told to have dominion over the earth, over the fowl of the earth, and to replenish the earth, and so forth. So God made us builders. We are economic beings because we reflect his nature. Tim.
In analyzing the Christian attitude towards the use of gold and silver coins, which I contend is a scriptural method of the medium of exchange, what good would be the gold or the silver or any other medium of exchange if it is separated from the land? By that, the value of exchange is the necessary human goods to exist with.
Okay, the question is, what good is gold and silver if man is disenfranchised from the land? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. Or the gold. Or the gold itself.
Yeah. Okay, God took care of this problem when the Israelites crossed the Jordan River going to the Promised Land by establishing the year of Jubilee. And if you look and see what he did, first before the Israelites crossed in the Promised Land, what happened in Egypt? God used Joseph to enslave the Egyptians. Remember, during the 7 years of plenty, the government accumulated a lot of grain, and during the 7 years of drought, it sold the grain back to the Egyptians, and finally they sold their lands and their cattle and so forth. And remember, back in Genesis 47:24 or something like that, Joseph, speaking on behalf of Pharaoh, says, "This day I have bought you, I own you, in fact, from this day on, 20% of what you produce," which is a tyrannical percentage, "belongs to Pharaoh." And as a result of the people being disenfranchised from the land, they became slaves to Pharaoh. My understanding is up until this time, the Egyptians had for the period of free economy. They were not slaves. And later on, of course, when the Israelites were enslaved. Remembering this, then when the Israelites went into the Promised Land, God divided the land according to the tribes and families, and he made a provision to make sure that no one could be permanently disenfranchised from the land, because he established the year of Jubilee, so every 50th year, if someone, because of poor fortune or something, had sold their land, it would devolve back to the family, to the heirs, and then it would be come back to the family ownership. And look at Leviticus chapter 24-25 for that. Now that brings us to a problem, and I discussed this problem in a supplement from one of the chapters. One supplement entitled The Land Problem in Mexico. Because if we look the world over, we find that one opportunity that the communists and Marxists have of disrupting society and instigating revolution is using the fact that many people in many countries have been permanently disenfranchised from the land. And there is a real need for them to be put back in contact with the land. Because God, notice, God's principle calls for this. As long as you can take man's labor and connect it with the land, he can produce all the wealth he needs. And so if you see what God's vision was, it was to put man in direct contact with the land, and from this, man can build economic and political freedom. And by the way, spiritual freedom is tied to economic and political freedom. Because government can use, if you lose your economic freedom, you're going to lose your political freedom. And if you lose your political freedom, the government can create the state educational systems, which will eventually undermine biblical truth and enslave the populace spiritually. So they're all tied together. So one problem we have the world over is how can we get people back in touch with the land? And the communists use this real problem to incite revolutionary activity. They say, as they did in Russia in 1917, they said, support us, the Bolsheviks, and we'll give you bread and land. When they came to power, the peasants that supported them got neither bread nor land. As a matter of fact, the kulaks were purposely massacred, and some 7 million of them were killed. Now there's only 7 million of the some 66 to 80 million people that have been purposely slaughtered by the communist regime in Soviet Union since 1917. So it's a real problem. And one problem that we have as Christians is, okay, how biblically can we apply the principle of the Jubilee to make sure that our own people aren't permanently disenfranchised from the land? I kind of have an answer. Remember I posed a question to you about suppose we were settling on an island. How would you handle a land problem? Well, God's provision is for individual ownership of the land. But God's word also says that the land he has given as a gift to the children of men. Which tells me that as new children are born into society, that they should have a pro rata share in the land. One way of handling this, and it's easy when you think of moving in as a new society on an island, suppose we got together and said, okay, what are we going to do about land ownership? Well, let's hold it individually, but what I would like to suggest we might want to do is create a mutual fund where everyone has, every citizen, as they're born into the community or immigrate into the community, is given one share of stock in the ownership of the land. And then the land then is rented to individuals who will pay a market price for that. That goes into a fund, and that is divided among the people, and then people would draw an income from the rental of the land. It would still be private ownership, wouldn't be government ownership. I fear government ownership of the land. And one thing, we have about 2 or 3 minutes left, if we look at the land ownership in this country, we see that our own federal government owns over 30% of the land area in this country. There is no reason for that. Land should be put in private hands, and the power thus dispersed throughout our country. So we have a land problem that's growing in our country too.